Hello, everyone, and welcome to our NEPT core content Q&A call. This is a call where you can ask me questions about whatever module you're working on, whatever you want to know, whatever you want clarification on, whether it be lab testing or blood sugar balancing or digestive issues or any other things like that that you maybe, you know, just want clarification on or need more advice on in terms of what we're doing in the module. So we've decided to add these calls. They're new this year. And the reason that we added them is because I think people felt a little intimidated coming to some of the other open coaching calls and the case study and lab calls because it's like, well, people are asking all these questions related to clients and cases, and I don't have any clients with any issues or I don't have clients yet. And so we decided to add these calls so we could really get into the geeky biochemistry, you know, stuff. And I know some of these calls we've delved into some lab things. You know, in the more advanced labs are probably not the appropriate place for on this particular call because we haven't really studied those in depth yet. But any of the basic blood chem stuff is really good stuff to be talking about here because it's the stuff that you're going to learn, you're going to hear me speak about, you're going to look at labs, you're going to get confused, then you're going to figure stuff out, and every time you're going to learn new stuff. And every time you're going to, you know, people are not textbooks as we know, and you're going to see some unusual presentations. And when that happens, it's really good to have access to a call like this. So the way we'll work it is that I'd love to hear what module you're working on right now, what you're excited about, and where you're at and what questions you might have or what comments you might have about how you've put it to work in your practice. I know Shonda posts a lot that she takes the various modules and she creates handouts for her patients that she can teach people. And that's a great way for you to reinforce your learning and to be able to share that with the people that you're working with. So raise your hand with a 1 on your telephone keypad if you have any questions or comments or topics you'd like us to discuss today. Open for discussion, even if you don't have a particular question per se, if there's something that you'd just like to discuss or get into more detail on, feel free. So a 1 on your telephone keypad. Nobody, huh? This is going to be a short call then, huh? We've got Sequoia. Let me open up Sequoia's line. Hi there, Sequoia.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can hear you perfectly.
Oh, okay. I don't know whether I'm talking on Maestro or if I'm talking on Skype.
So you dialed in on Skype, but you used like the MC Direct or something?
Yes.
Yeah, so that gets you into Maestro. So it's almost like calling a friend at their house. You know, you're talking to them on their phone if you dial in from Skype, even though you're talking on Skype. The same way here. When you use that code, it actually gets you into the Maestro. So you don't appear to be any different to me than anybody else. You just look like you've called in.
Okay. So I, you know, here in Canada, there's some restrictions. And so one of the things that we had been able to get but we're no longer able to get is the total T4, even if you pay for it privately. So,
really?
Yes, and which is, you know, I don't know if that's going to change, but that's the way it is at the moment. And so if you're, like, if somebody's getting the TSH, the free T3, the free T4 done, and they can pay for the reverse T3, is it worth getting it done if you don't have the total T4?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what the total T4 gives you is, like, how really is the thyroid functioning? What's the total of what it's doing? So if that's low and you start to make assumptions about why the free numbers are low, well, if the total is low, well, that's why the free number is low. So it kind of is like giving you pieces of the puzzle without giving you that starting point. Is it worth it? Sure, you can get a lot of information. Certainly if you find that their free T3 is low and their free T4 is normal, then you know they do have a conversion issue from the 4 to the 3. But if both of those are low, right, you don't know if it's low because there's a binding globulin issue, right? Too much binding globulin, and the free numbers are very low, but the total would be higher or not. I mean, you can kind of guess that. You can do inferences. So if you had the total T3, the free T3, free T4, and you're dealing with a situation where both the free numbers were low, but the free T3 was decent, then you might be thinking, okay, even though I don't have the total T4, it could be a binding globulin issue. So there's certain situations where you can infer and guess. Other situations where you're like, who knows, right? If I don't have the total T3 or the total T4, and you have low, I don't know if it's just the thyroid's not producing enough or if it's a binding globulin issue. And binding globulin issues, as we learned in, and we'll go into way more detail in our detailed thyroid module, can be an issue with excess estrogen. So if we see somebody who's on birth control pills or they're on hormone replacement therapy or they're doing a lot of xenoestrogens, environmental estrogens, dental amalgams, things like that, then you might think that, well, maybe their estrogens are high and it's causing an increase in the binding globulin and causing the free fractions to be low. So is it worth it? Sure. I mean, you're going to get information. Is it a complete picture? No. We don't know really what the thyroid is fully doing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's just a little frustrating.
Oh, I bet. Because it's a number that most doctors don't do. If I had to choose two, I would choose total T4 and free T3, because at least I've got the beginning and the end, right? Mm-hmm. And I can guess and, you know, make sense about what's happening in between. But I really want to know what the thyroid is doing and capable of. And TSH, as you know very well, does not cut it when it comes to telling you what the thyroid's doing, because the thyroid could be producing beautifully, but the TSH could be off because of a pituitary issue or feedback issue. So we don't really know. And when we want to look at, well, is the thyroid functioning okay? Is it still able to produce? The total T4 is a good number to have for that. Free T4, it's just not the same.
So, I mean, I've got these results on, blood chemistry software. And I don't know if this would be an appropriate time to have a quick look at that.
I'd have to log into the blood chemistry. And somebody else has their hands up right now. Oh, Mary had her hand up and put it down. Let me go in and open up blood chemistry software. And is this yours?
Yes, it's mine.
I'm
the up, down, right? <It's> like
so people don't realize when they join this program that the side benefit is they get a lot of work on themselves. Good side benefit. So I'm going into the endocrinology setup. I should be able to see yours. Let me find it. If I go view patients. Do you have it in as your name or do you have it as SS or what? How do you have
it? S Sequoia.
Okay, S. Wow, you guys have been putting lots of people in here. We have four full pages full. That's so cool. Okay, SS. S. Sequoia. Why am I not seeing it?
S for Sequoia? Sequoia?
S and then Sequoia, so it should be SS, right?
Yeah.
That's weird. STSSSO. Let me just type in SEQUOIA and see what happens. Oh, S dot Sequoia. Okay, I was looking in the wrong spot. Okay, good. All right, so gotcha. We've got a snapshot. Latest lab test was April 15th, right? Well, you've got a lot of them in here. Okay, so you've been following regularly. So let me generate the report from that, and that'll show me the last seven or whatever that I can see.
Are you going to share this on Join Me?
I can. Let me just get it up first. I like to get it up there first because otherwise people see the whole list of, and I don't like those things to be on the videos, the whole list of patients. So, okay, so they changed it in the order that they do it. Let's see, join me, share, okay, share window. Okay, can you see it? Anybody
yeah.
on join me? Okay, so I'm going to scroll down to the, oh, so this one, here we go. So we have the TSH. This only shows two, but isn't there a section? There is a section where they show the back one. So your TSH is back down to, or is up again.
Yeah.
And your free T3 is the same, and your free T4 is down. And we don't have the total, so I'm going to infer from this that the reason that your free T4 is down is that your total T4 is down. And that's what caused the TSH to go up. We have a previous one. Okay, here we go, the previous one. Here we go, TSH. This is reverse order, right? Oh, that's 12 up to 16. So the latest one is here. All right, so you were up back in that December when you had that February 2014. So you were really low in December, and you've come up. Free T4 has gone from too high, 2.1 to 1.17, and then into normal range, and now it's too low. Free T3 was way too high. So you were in a hypothyroid state here, it got here, but now you're showing you're in a hypothyroid state. So what's changed? What have you done differently between?
Well, that was just going off. That was just going off the pregnenolone.
Okay.
I haven't done anything else different.
2 months for it to come back. But really, we don't have anything before that. Just the TSH before that. It was a little high before. So we don't know what the numbers were back when you had the TSH of 3, which was when earlier in the 2014, and then nothing in between. And then, so, you know, maybe there's a magic dose of the pregnenolone. I don't know if you've gone back and redone your adrenals to see if you still need that, but your thyroid
no, I'm the person that, you know, two drops put me over the edge, so...
Two drops once a day. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then one drop was putting me over the edge, was making me hyper. So I'm a little reluctant to go back onto it.
Oh, yeah, no, I wouldn't. No, not with two drops. I was thinking that you were on more of a normal dose and you could find a complementary part. So there's clearly something going on with your thyroid. It's probably been going on since 2014 here. Have you looked at iodine levels? And... Yeah,
well,
I don't think it's an issue as much as a...
That was going to be my next, was to try the iodine, because the TPO and the TSI and the other one, the thyroglobulin antibodies, were all kind of a little borderline, you know, there's a little something there, but they were below, you know, sufficiently
yeah.
low in
that low I thought that thyroid... autoimmune. Yeah, and you can do the iodine load test because Hakala will ship to Canada, and that's usually what I recommend before you play around with it, just to make sure, because it might be a bromine toxicity as well, right? It might be that your bromine's high, and that's what you can tell by doing the full panel that they do, the halides panel. But if you were going to try to just play with this and get this tested again, I don't know how, you know, do your doctor actually do this, or do you have to pay out of pocket to retest each time?
No, I'm on a standing order for the TSH, the free T3 and the free T4.
Okay. And what is the doctor about this? Did they have anything to say at all?
Well, they're, as far as the, oh, well, it's all in normal range.
They don't look at the comparison, like, what happened here, and why is this
They only look when it's hyper, and that's the only reason I'm allowed to get the free T3 and free T4 done, because I had a diagnosis of hyper.
Right, but as soon as you get two or three of these TSHs in this abnormal hypo range, they're going to say, we can't do this anymore, right?
No, I think I've got a standing order for a year.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah, so you can experiment then. You can experiment with it. But I would start really gently with the iodine. I generally don't recommend doing it, and when you're working with your patients, really be careful with iodine because there's so much press about how it can, you know, trigger Hashimoto's, which I don't really believe. I mean, there are rare cases where it does, but I don't think it triggers Hashimoto's. I think there's other things going on. And so I think it's just really a matter of finding the right dose. So when you're working with people, be really careful and make sure they, you know, you recommend the testing and that you caution them against supplementing unless they've tested, just to cover yourself. But I think that in your case, since you are the manager of your own health, I can tell you what I think. And but if I would tell you what I would do in your situation. If I didn't want to go get the iodine load test, I'd probably start with like 150 micrograms of iodine. And really monitor, because you're very sensitive, so you'll see. Mm-hmm. If you start to feel any of the hyper symptoms, then back off. But if you don't, then you can up it gradually, you know, by 150 micrograms each time, and then you have a standing order to get this once a month. So you'll be able to do that, you know, for 4 weeks, see how it goes, and then do it again the next month and play with the doses. So you can actually titrate and see. If it is related to the iodine, and figure it out pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that was what I wanted to do before, but I wanted to wait for my results to come back from the different antibodies. So
yeah.
So that now that I've got them, I'm like, well, I think I can risk this.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I've had people who have had, you know, raging Hashimoto's with high levels, but I've put them I've done an iodine load test and seen that they needed it, and it if anything, it brought the antibody levels down.
And you know, and they've said even when people have Hashimoto's, there's been thousands and thousands of people that have gone on to iodine, and then they have, you know, sometimes the antibody levels will raise for the first few months, but then they kind of come back to normal.
Right.
After about 6 to 12 months. So it's taking all that into consideration, right?
There's a lot to take into consideration. And what Dr. Wilson said when we talked to him, or when I talked to him on the after call with him, he had said that it's very common for the TSH to go up, and people think that it's problematic. And really, it will do that for a while, and he calls it kind of almost like a negative feedback loop, like the body's going, oh, look, we have plenty of iodine now. We can stimulate the thyroid more. And then it, you know, it could be 3 months, 6 months, 9 months before the TSH levels out. But you go by how you're feeling. You know, he said you go by how the person's feeling. If they go on this iodine and they feel like $1 million, I had that happen with a person. I mean, she, during the iodine load test, taking that 50 milligrams, she goes, oh, my God, I haven't felt that good in years. Can I just keep taking it? Do I have to wait for the test results to come back? I said, just take it until the test results come back, and we'll figure it out after it comes back. So if you're starting to feel better, right, you're feeling more clear, more energetic, you're not getting racing heart, but you just feel better, we can't necessarily know by the TSH. You know, the TSH isn't going to go suddenly drop down. It might go up before it comes down.
Yeah, I'm getting some palpitations sometimes, so I'm kind of, but I'm not exactly sure what the reason for that is.
How does it compare to what you were getting back in December?
Oh, completely different. It's completely different. I mean, the hyper is a horrible, horrible feeling.
Oh, yeah, and you were clearly hyper. Look at your 5.27. 4.75, I mean, on a free T3, you're raging like that. You're racing like that. Right? So, but now at 2.3, I don't think, you know, your thyroid isn't going to cause palpitations with those numbers.
Yeah, something's causing palpitations, but I'm not sure what it is.
Something. So often is it happening?
Give me a 24-hour halter test.
Yeah.
So.
What'd you find?
We haven't done it yet. I've just booked it, so it's not.
Yeah, so do it and see. And hopefully you'll have the palpitations within that 24 hours if it's irregular.
I'll make sure I'm doing everything that would stress me out in those 24 hours.
And do you find that when you have those palpitations, it's because you're stressed about something in your life? Or is it related to caffeine? You don't do caffeine, right?
No, I don't do caffeine. I found when I took magnesium, and it's very strange. I found I took magnesium, I went to bed, and it was like, oh, I'm getting palpitations. I'm wondering if there's something I need to take with that magnesium to stop, you know, that there's something else that's needed.
Mm. I mean, I would think magnesium would be, because it's a calmer, right? It calms muscle, smooth muscle and skeletal muscle. That it would be, if you said calcium, I might say, oh, well, take magnesium with it, right? But you're taking magnesium. I mean, you could look at the excipients and see what else is in there. Is it a citrate or a glycinate or whatever?
It's L3 in it, but I've found that before. And not just with L3 in it, but with the magnesium citrate, that it's happened and it's, and I'm like, it seems to be related to this. And I'm like, it doesn't make any sense that it's related to that. But
is a calmer, right? We give that to kids with attention deficit and all. You know, some people are paradoxical responders, too. I have somebody who, when she can't sleep, she takes coffee and she falls asleep like a baby.
Mm.
You know, so there's people that just have that paradoxical response. I would try switching to maybe magnesium taurate, because it's bound with taurine, and taurine's a precursor to GABA, and see if that calms things, if that makes a difference.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I'm short of GABA.
Yeah, well then try that. That might help.
It does, but I don't like taking single amino acids for any length of time.
Well, this is magnesium done with taurate, you know, and you just, it's really, think of it as experimentation right now. So when you get answers,
the conference will automatically end in 5
looks like nobody's on there, so Mike, I'm going to get knocked out. You know, think about this as any supplementation that you're doing right now is not as a long-term plan, because really we're trying to get to the root, and sometimes it's by experimenting with what you take or don't take, and seeing what the response is, you get to look back and say, okay, what pathways are involved and what's really involved here. So not as a long-term effect, but more to see, is that really what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, it's an experiment. And it's the same thing with our patients, our clients, right? Like, we're not necessarily saying, okay, go take this and this will just mask the symptoms and be good for the rest of your life. It's like, oh, when she did this, this happened. When she did that, that happened. And the more data points you have to analyze, the more you can dig in and start to pull up biochemical pathways maybe you've never looked at before and be able to understand why it may be happening.
Well, one of the things that was happening is that I'd turn over in bed and my heart would start racing, and I'm like, I've hardly moved.
Wow. Was that when you were having thyroidism, or that was...
This has been for the last few months, and then after about a minute and a half, 2 minutes, it settles down again. It goes down to about 70, and then it, you know, but if I turn over again, it goes up to about 90, 100.
That's crazy. I think you need to do this Holter monitor and see what's going on there and see what they show in terms of patterns, but there's something... It seems musculoskeletal structural that's doing, I mean, turning over. That, you know, that involves the rib cage, it involves the scalene muscles, the muscles in the neck, it involves a lot of the trunk muscles. Is there something that's affecting that? Have you had any adjustments, like spinal adjustments? I've seen people respond dramatically to when the thoracic spine is out of alignment and having, you know, what seems like heart problems, but it's really having to do with the somatovisceral response.
Yeah, well, I have been going to chiropractor, but I stopped for the last month, and I'm looking at going to a different one. But I'm not out of breath if I go up the stairs or anything. To me, it's strange, right? I'm like, I can't figure this one out.
Yeah, this is that's interesting, because there's something related to the you know, the turning over, so you want to think about what muscles are involved with that, what's involved with that, or is it something, I mean, does it happen when you do other movements? Really exercise, classes, lifting weights, any of that?
Well, only if I do, you know, that, like when I'm doing the burst exercise, but I mean, I have to work at it to get it up.
Yeah, that's supposed to raise your heart rate. That's exercise. You know, I'm talking, you know, simple things. So, you know, typical weight lifting is not, unless you're doing very high levels and doing it rapidly, wouldn't raise your heart rate necessarily.
But no, I'm just sticking to burst training, and that's, you know, I'm being a little cautious because I'm not sure what's going on with the heart, so I'm sticking to burst training, which seems to be fairly safe. Going up and down stairs, walking, cycling, you know, just being a little cautious.
Do they have plans for doing like an echocardiogram or something to see, to measure, or a stress test to see what's going on?
They've done the ECG, but I haven't had the results of that.
Okay. Well, keep me posted on how that goes. And do the halter monitor as soon as you can, especially, and turn over in bed. And if you know how to recreate it, just make sure you turn over a couple of times with the monitor on so we can see what's going on.
I feel like I'm still in stage two of adrenal.
30 seconds.
Sorry.
So I think just about stage two. I don't feel I'm in stage three. I feel it's about stage two of the adrenal stress. But that's, it's still anomaly here. I'm kind of like, I don't know what's going on.
Right, right. And the pregnenolone, to have that dramatic effect with such a low dose, we have to look at some of those pathways.
Conference ending. Goodbye.
I know you saw some articles about that, but I want to look at, well, what's the specific interaction
there's a lot. There's another area that I'm and I think it's to do with the greens. You still
what
there?
Do you mean it's to do with the greens?
Yeah. Because I find if I have greens maybe twice a day, then the next day, you know, I can still be tired. But if I have it three or four times a day, I feel good. So that there seems to be something, it's like I seem to need, shall we say, extreme amounts of greens.
What is that? When you say, when people say three or four times a day, I mean, it depends, how much does that mean? Like in terms of green smoothies, stir fries, juices, how much volume of greens does that turn out to be on the days you feel good versus the days you still feel tired?
I'd say I just had, I don't know how to put it in a juicer full, right? a jug full. So if I have a jug full, that's not enough.
Meaning like 16 ounces, 32 ounces, and you're talking juice or smoothie or both or either?
I'm talking about, so if I take the greens raw, unjuiced, and put them, fill it up in a blender, a Blendtec blender, right, in the large container. That is not enough for me. I have to have, and actually I don't even know if it's quantity or the number of times per day.
Yeah.
But, and it could possibly be the number of times per day.
Check that out.
I've noticed the difference with that for sure.
Yeah.
And somebody,
well, I know for sure that I do much better if I have multiple iterations of green. So I usually do. I'll do it in the morning. Although today I haven't had anything yet. Interesting. I'll do it in the morning, and then maybe I'll have it at night again, and then in the middle I'll just have eating green. So I do really well on large quantities of greens. And I think that, you know, when we're talking several pounds of greens a day can be, because it's really replenishing minerals. It's keeping your mineral levels up. It's keeping, you know, giving you good sources of amino acids. So, you know, I think that's part of finding your own unique blends. You know, some people have more resilience, maybe. Do you have MTHFR genetic shift?
Yeah, I have the 1670.
Yeah, so, you know, so you're needing more, and that gives you more folate, which helps to supply, you know, the right blood cell maturation, your DNA repair, and all those other energizing things, right? So mm-hmm. you need more, and I know you don't like to take supplements, so you're not probably not taking a whole bunch of stuff. So your body's saying, well, you're not going to give it to me in food, just, you know, really balance it out. So I would eat the level of greens on a regular basis that you know make you feel most energized. That just makes sense for you to feel the best you can every day.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. And make sure your D is, because your D was miserable back last year or 2 years ago, whenever that number was.
Yeah.
Don't see an additional D. Just make sure, because, you know, little things like we just, oh, yeah, the D, maybe it's okay. That makes a huge difference. Huge difference.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and
I don't know.
I take a bit of D every day. And
you don't
I'm
know
just,
if it's the right amount because you haven't had it tested since 2012. So you may be taking enough 30 or 40 or 50. That still might not be enough. So whenever I'm working with somebody on D, I like to do a quarterly D test until we get them to their proper amount and then start to space it out and make sure that whatever they're taking, whatever sun exposure they're doing, is keeping it at the level we want, because it's very easy for it to drop off. And I've seen people who, you know, can take 20,000 for 6 weeks and jump from 8 to 100. I've seen people who would take 20,000 for a year and a half and jump from 8 to 50, right? And I've seen this. And it's very, very variable, and there's a lot of SNPs that relate to D. You know, in addition to the VDR, the vitamin D receptors, there's the FUT2, which I have a lousy one, which has to do with membranes, mucous membranes. But there's also a couple of others. I can't remember off the top of my head which they are. I have a list of them. I think I put in last year Shine had a chart with some of those in there. So you don't know, and there may be some we haven't even discovered yet, right? So we all have to find that balance. You live in Canada, right? You can lay naked on the roof all year long and probably not get enough D to keep your levels. Right?
Well,
so have a look at that. If you Bahamas, what's that?
I says we've been getting a lot of sunshine here. You're like 4 months straight sunshine, which is a lot, right? For here.
Right. Was it in the summer or the winter?
But I am dark skinned, right? So I have olive skin, and so I need more than most people.
More than most. That's right. That's right. So you know, I would don't discount the simple vitamin D test too, to be involved here, because it's so much related to thyroid health and gut health and so much. And we've got to not, you know, a lot of people just want to do the test once, take some level, and they think they're okay. And that's what the doctors tell them. Oh, you're low. Here, take this dose. How long should I take it for? Oh, take it for 3 to 6 months. When do I get tested again? Oh, you don't need to. That's just not reliable. It's not responsible. So I think you need to do that for yourself, is to get another D test and optimize your D levels.
Yeah, and I've also I'm intending getting another one. When I go to the doctor, I don't like to ask for too much at once. but it's for the next visit. I'm going to ask for the reverse T3 and the D, and that'll go down okay.
Okay.
So
if you have a choice, get the vitamin D. I would prioritize that above the reverse T3.
And I noticed that Mercola, and I've just ordered some, has put on a new D3, and so I've just ordered that one to see if that one will help better for me. You know,
it varies from form to form, company to company, person to person. And I had one, and she tried every single one of the D3s. And she wanted it to be vegan, so she tried all the vegan D3s, and she was getting up to like 50,000 a day, testing herself every 4 to 6 weeks and wasn't budging. Same thing with her husband, and then he found one that worked for him, and he got his to jump up, but it still didn't work for her. And then she ended up switching to a D2, and her numbers got up. So it's so variable from person to person.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm going to try this, and I like the fact there was 5,000 in each capsule. I thought that, yeah, that'll do.
Yeah,
that's less to keep, right?
So I definitely would give it a try. And before you start taking something new, get a baseline, because then you don't know. You start to compare apples and oranges. So if you test somebody, if somebody has a low level of something and they're not doing something for a really long time and they still have a low level, and then you start something, well, you don't test them, you just start something. You don't know if what they did before they started that thing helped or that thing helped. So if you really want to evaluate it, don't just start taking that. Get your test done and then start taking it.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, because you don't want to compare apples and oranges. It's really hard. You want to really be able to get some scientific numbers when you're helping people to move the needles on this. Okay? So I'm going to go on
okay,
to another question. So thank you. This is a great question. And Sequoia was the only one with a hand up. So anybody else have a question, comment, anything to share, anything you want to say to Sequoia on her little situation, any questions you have about labs, about digestion, about anything else? Okay, so Laura. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Dr. Rita Marie.
Hey.
Hey, I was going to ask just a personal question about still dealing with some sleep issues, and I've tried some herbal supplements, but it was like things that were combined, like it was several things together. And I didn't know if you had any insight as far as like with your clients that are struggling with sleep, where you like particular herbs that you just start with them, or I didn't know if I should just take that sheet from the CAFE program about herbs for sleep and just muscle test and see which ones kind of jump out. I wanted to just try a couple combinations and see if that made a difference, but still struggling with that a little bit.
So it just depends, because with herbs, it's like there's all these indications. So if I know that somebody's laying there and their mind is racing, I love passion flower for that, but you can combine passion flower if it doesn't work on its own or it just takes the edge, and you can say, well, let's try lemon balm. And it really, I mean, if you have the tool of muscle testing, I think it's a great tool to use. You can rule out certain ones when you read the indications, like, you know, no, this one doesn't sound like a good one for me. And then I think muscle testing is a great way. And then combos. So when, for example, when I was going to have my surgery on my arm a few years back, I wanted to be able to relax during the surgery. I wasn't going to do anesthesia. I was going to do local, but I wanted to be able to relax and take the edge off. And I started, like, I had the herbs around that I thought, oh, this would be good. Oh, this would be good. Oh, this would be good. And then what I did was I had this bunch, and I said, well, let's muscle test. Let's just see. And I had some surprising results. But I followed it. I did what my body was saying it needed, and I, you know, was mellow. I was able to relax, but I didn't fall asleep, and it worked really well. But, you know, you use the combination of intellect with the energy. You know what I mean? So you think about it. You don't just take go to the store and buy a whole bunch of stuff or stand there muscle testing everything on the shelf. You read, you understand what the indications are for these things. And then when you're down to these four or five things, you're going, I don't know which one's going to be best for me or what order, then you can use the muscle testing to confirm or to ask your body what it needs in the moment. And the other thing is it might need different things at different times. You may have to start with one combination and then go to another. So those things that are listed in CAFE, I'm working on a sleep module that's probably within another month, I'm hoping, keep my fingers crossed.
I know. I'm so excited about that.
No, but you know, the thing is, I take all the stuff that I've already, and I go, oh no, but that's not enough. Let me go check out this. So I really spend more time creating these modules than I anticipate because I am afraid to leave anything out. So that module should hopefully be coming soon. But there's things like you have to look at, like what's going on for you when you're having trouble falling asleep. Do you feel like this restlessness in your body? Are your muscles kind of twitchy or achy or whatever? You know, then you want to combine magnesium or an Epsom salts bath or some sort of magnesium sulfate bath or topical magnesium with whatever else you're doing as well if you feel kind of a little restless type of thing. If you're feeling like it's like the mind and the distraction of the mind, the passion flower works well. If you've had a test, adrenal test, and you're having high cortisol levels, then you want to look at things that are going to dampen that, like magnolia and phosphatidylserine, right? If you're having memory issues and sleep issues, maybe phosphatidylserine would be good because it has those phospholipids that help the brain. You know, there's so many variations it could be, and there's no one formula. Some people like to start with formulas. I'm not a big formula person just because I work with a lot of folks with a lot of food allergies and sensitivities, and they invest in a formula that has five ingredients and they have a bad reaction, then they've just wasted their money. We don't know which one is not working. And so I like to start with a bunch of different things. Tinctures are relatively inexpensive, so you can start by playing with it. I had one person whose sleep was dramatically improved with ashwagandha and Shizandra at bedtime. And probiotics. She found that if she didn't take her probiotics at bedtime along with those, she didn't sleep quite as well as she did when she did take the probiotics. So I think it's a matter of combination of trial and error, knowing where to start, trying to base it on a person. And, you know, when you're working with yourself, you can be as experimental as you want. But sometimes when you're working with a client, you know that this person is not going to do it if they have to open up three different bottles and take them at bedtime. So that's a situation where you might want to start with a formula, you know, read up on the different herbs that are in it and see if it matches them, if there's any contraindications. Like I wouldn't put there right now on an ashwagandha because it can help to increase thyroid function. And she's been having this problem with back and forth on, you know, the hyperthyroid. So we think about those things. If somebody's really hot, you know, a hot constitution, we want to stay away from certain things. But actually, this person was ashwagandha, Shizandra. I think she had magnesium in there. So that's what I would do is I would just go through and just, like, muscle test yourself and really tune in to see which ones might work.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah, I will try that.
Okay. Good for you. Keep me posted.
Okay, will do.
Okay. Okay, any other questions? We have a good showing today, but you all guys are quiet listening. So this is a call where we're here to talk about content, about modules, about specific geeky biochemistry questions, and like Sequoia was able to turn that and twist that around into a very good questions that, you know, related to certain things about the blood chemistry, but then related to herself. So feel free. If you don't have specific content questions and you have other questions that you want to ask, as long as nobody's raising their hand with specific content questions, I'll go ahead and entertain any questions at this point. So raise your hand with a 1 if you have a specific, like, module content biochemistry type question, and a 5 if you have just any other question. And Mary, I know you had your hand up earlier and it went down, so if you still have a question, go ahead and put it up again because there's no hands up right now. In chat. Yeah, so great conversation going on in there with a lot of good stuff in there. I'm gonna Lynn, make sure we save that chat because there's some good stuff in there. So we have Allison, and then we have Sequoia. So, Allison, hello. Make sure you're not muted. I don't know if you're on Skype, but check your microphone, your computer mic. I have you. Let me make sure I have your line open. I think I do. Oh. No, that's Jamie.
No.
Sorry.
No. Hello.
Yeah, there you are. Yeah.
You can hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, good. Hi, everybody. Great to connect with you all. I've managed to make a couple of elixirs, and I went out and bought some hormone-balancing herbal tinctures to add to my elixirs for my webinars and things. One question, I'd like to get really secure in my head. where you don't recommend people have tea or coffee between meals or any food between meals, are they allowed to have the elixirs between meals? And would we be allowed to have just a herbal tea, like a licorice tea or something like that, or tulsi tea in the evening?
Yeah, good question. So the reason for spacing and not eating between meals is anytime you're eating any macronutrients, it's going to trigger an insulin release. So if we're dealing with insulin resistance, if we're dealing with any kind of blood sugar imbalances or weight issues where somebody has they don't want to lose, that they can't lose, then triggering that insulin response puts them into fat storage mode rather than fat burning. Plus, if they've got any SIBO issues, their migrating motor complex is an issue, and we need to have that 3, 4, 5 hours between meals to really allow the migrating motor complex to work. That said, so that means that herbal teas are just fine. That's not going to increase any insulin unless you're putting honey in those herbal teas, right? So just a straight herbal tea, even if it's sweetened with a little stevia, that's not going to trigger an insulin response. So that's fine. The elixirs, on the other hand, will trigger a response of insulin because they're full of macronutrients and micronutrients. So if you're dealing with somebody who's skinny, I a lot of times put people on those in between meals to raise their energy, but also to help them to not lose so much weight. But for the most part, you know, the elixirs are better with a meal or as an instead of a meal. So if I'm going to have an elixir, you know, every now and then I will have an elixir, like, late at night. Like, I had one last night at midnight because I knew I had, like, 4 more hours worth of work. I stayed up till 4:30 making videos. So I knew I was going to have to be. I made an elixir of coconut milk and, what was it, coconut milk and not ashwagandha, cordyceps. And it really, I flew through the night, and I made it to 4:30 and made 5 videos, and I did it, but it's not something I recommend on a regular basis. So I usually recommend that the elixirs are good as a before or after, you know, right before dinner as you're making dinner, you know, you have your elixir while you're making your dinner, so you're not firing up the digestion and firing up the hormonal response to food so many times. But again, if the person's real thin or there's extenuating circumstances like they have it because they're going to be staying up late, then you certainly can do it that way.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Good question. It is a good question because it does come up a lot. And the other thing I have people, and Shonda posted it on the Facebook page, was that she just had this sugar craving, and she managed to satisfy the sugar craving by making an elixir. So that was that, you know, those are kind of things we all have to, we have to balance the ideal with the real, right? We have Sequoia. Hello, Sequoia.
Hi.
Hello.
Yes, hi.
Hi. So, I have this client, and she has a extremely ridiculously heavy periods, you know, that last for about 2 weeks. And her iron is, like, awfully, awfully low, just horribly, horribly low. And so, she goes and she has her, by the way, her doctor refuses to do a serum iron. Because the reason, he does the ferritin, because he is convinced it's to do with the periods. Well, I'm like, well, you know, we don't really know. Anyway.
No, people think that when they have those heavy periods that the iron is going to be low as a result, but oftentimes low iron that triggers the heavy periods, and it's paradoxical, it just seems weird, but it's very, very common that the body bleeds excessively when the iron is low. So, the iron in this person's body is going to help in many ways, of course, to replenish the lost blood that for 2 weeks is bleeding, but also to help to stop that. Now, I like natural forms of iron better because iron can be constipating and iron can be oxidative, and we ought to be careful about people who are postmenopausal taking iron. But I like yellow dock as a good source, nettles, another good source, sea vegetables, you know, just all these high mineral foods. But sometimes just getting her on a good food form of iron, like the Vitamin Code has one that works very well. I've had people skyrocket their numbers very quickly with that and help with periods. And but has she always had the period problem, or is the period problem relatively new?
No, she's quite young. I think she's only in her 30s, but she's had this for a long time, and with very low iron, very low.
Yeah. I would be looking at getting her on a good elixir that's going to support her adrenals, that's going to support her minerals with, you know, nettles in there and some of the high foods and make it taste good. So it's not just like she's taking these supplements. You can even put a dropper of yellow dock, or you can put powdered yellow dock in there. Yellow dock.
Yellow dock.
I was thinking yarrow, and then, it's not yarrow, it's yellow dock. And have her make this, like, this really, like, energizing, blood-supportive food that she can drink, you know, that would have her vitamin C and some iron sources and just really nourishing, and see what that does. But definitely I think the iron is super important.
Yeah, it's just very frustrating, again, because, you know, you can't get the blood test to check it out.
Yeah, but, you know, that's something that you're going to notice a difference. It may take a period or two to see a difference, but basically to get the iron levels and get the iron integrated into the hemoglobin and into the system is going to take, you know, 120 days to get the whole thing happening. But I've seen really great results at 6 to 8 weeks.
Right. She's at nine. It was nine last time for the ferritin.
It's abysmal. Yeah. And you know that the reason I like to get both is because, and some of the people on the
Hello?
Hello? Can you hear me? Did I disappear? Nicoya? If you're still hearing me, raise your hand. You can still hear me. Lynn says you can still hear me. So, Sequoia, it sounds like you might have bugged out. I don't know if you could. Oops, she disappeared. Anyway, you know, I was going to say, and she can hear it on the recording, or somebody can report back to her, that the reason I like to do both iron and ferritin, not just one or the other, lots of docs will just not do serum iron anymore, they just do the ferritin, is because if there's any liver issues going on, you might see a discrepancy. Like, you think that the iron's going to be low and the ferritin's going to be low, but sometimes the iron is low and the ferritin is high. Sometimes the ferritin is low and the iron is high, and that has to do with that storage mechanism. And then you start looking at what's going on in the liver. And with Laura, we discovered, I can't remember which way it was, but it was a melatonin thing when we started looking at pathways. So you can't just say, well, if the iron's low, then the ferritin's going to be low, or vice versa. You can't say that. And if it's not, then it points to other discrepancies that people can have. So Jane has her hand up. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I had a question that was regarding what Allison was talking about as far as, and when you were talking about spacing the meals.
Yeah.
And I know through our program, there's a lot of programs out there that do the opposite, they tout that, you know, people are losing a lot of weight. So what's that mechanism that's firing? And is there, you know, is one way better than the other way for certain people?
This is my biased opinion, that anybody that says it's better to eat more frequently, if they're not based in science, they're based on hearsay. Now, there might be mechanisms where you get people to eat less when they're doing that, because they're not feeling as hungry when they get to a meal, so they don't overeat. So that might be the mechanism. You have to look at what those programs are doing besides that. But I've found, if you look at the science, you look at researchers, you look at what happens with insulin and leptin and ghrelin and migrating motor complex, it just makes total sense to space the meals out. Total sense.
Yeah, and I understand that. I think it's probably, I think the program specifically that I'm thinking about is more of a calorie restriction.
Calorie restriction is, so if you eat every 2 hours but your total caloric intake is 1,000 calories in the day, you're likely going to lose weight, right?
And the weight
is going to happen while you're sleeping, not during the day, because you cannot, you just can't go into fat burning when the insulin is high. So if the insulin stays high, and it depends on what they're eating. If they're having them eat, you know, celery sticks and carrot sticks every 2 hours, that's different than people eating
right.
what they normally eat, which would be carbs, right? So yeah, you're not going to – that's why my snack attack strategy. Like, look at these things that you can do if you can't make it the distance between it. And you look at those things that are not going to send your blood sugars up through the roof.
Well, and people's digestive system will – their motility is going to be different too, and that's kind of hard to assess. But I'm
exactly.
I'm going to be sitting up against a church program that is doing the eat frequently model. But then again, this is for people who have never done any restriction in their diet whatsoever. So I'm trying to formulate my my responses because I know that I'm going to be called on and probably be potentially a leader in some of these at some point in the program.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, just really keep in mind that if it is a calorie restriction and they're saying, yeah, eat every 2 hours, but what they're saying is eat, you know, celery or carrots or cucumbers every 2 hours, that's way different than people eating foods that are going to trigger a big macronutrient influx and then insulin. So it could work. I'm not saying that those programs don't work, but when you look physiologically, so many people are on those eating every couple of hours and they just never get into fat burning.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Alma. And let me put your hand down, Jane. Let me see if I opened you up, Alma. No, I didn't. There you go.
Hello.
Now you're open. There you go. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. I just went through the module, the part of the third module on fat. Very fascinating
yep.
stuff.
Right.
I just need a little bit of, and I've read the materials too, and I'm just having a little bit of trouble exactly understanding that was, you know, that chart, the metabolism of omega-3 and omega-6, specifically the bottom half of the chart.
Okay, I'm gonna pull that up and I'll put it on the screen so I can make sure we're really clear that we're looking at the same thing. So we're looking at the macronutrients module. Are you still seeing my
yeah.
screen? Or
and is it?
Okay, it's just, oh, there it goes. So fat, and I think there's two or three videos in there. So which one are you looking at? And I'll open up the PDF of that.
This one is from the second video.
Second video, okay. So let me just pull up the slide.
How do I get on the screen that you're looking at? Join me.
Join.me. Join.me, and then the code is Dr. Rita Marie, Dr. Rita Marie. And then the chart is it the omega-3, the prostaglandin one? And there's a number of charts in here, so.
There's one, so the top says essential fatty acids, and then there's omega-3 on the left side, omega-6 on the right side, and by each one of them they have significant sources, and then how they're broken down, like how omega-3 goes from alpha-linolenic acid to pyridonic acid.
Yeah, I found it.
To EPA.
Modulation
okay.
one? Is that the one? The nutritional modulation is oleic on one side, alpha-linolenic on the other, and then it says sesame, sunflower, almond, pumpkin. And then in the other box, it says flax and chia. Is that the one? It has all the nutrients?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So what's your question on it?
So I just want to make sure I understand correctly. So omega-3, we take it in as ALA. And then
yep.
the delta-6 desaturase helps it convert to pyridonic acid, and then from there to EPA, right?
Right.
And then omega-6, it goes from LA to GLA to DGLA, and then
mm-hmm.
DGLA can go both ways. One is anti-inflammatory PG1, and the other one is arachidonic acid PG2, right?
Right, right.
So what's this in between delta 5 desaturase? And it shows that EPA can affect the arachidonic acid, as in bring it down a bit. I guess I'm just confused by the delta 5 desaturate part. Like,
find the chart
because
that
it's
has
kind of going in between.
Wrong chart. Let's see. Okay, here we go. Yeah, so the delta 5 desaturase will convert from, this again, I haven't looked in this in a long time. The delta 6 goes from the short chain, omegas, it elongates them. Basically, it's going to elongate them. Then you go from the medium, and the delta 5 will elongate them further into either EPA or AA.
Uh-huh.
So what's the question then?
Well, because a lot of the lecture was about how to make the delta 6 work better. Does that mean the delta 5 just automatically works?
That doesn't tend to
be
the rate limiting factor, and I think some of the same cofactors will work. Not 100%, but yeah, those cofactors generally tend to work. So it's not, so delta 6 desaturase has so many cofactors that you've got to focus on getting people through there. Once you do, in the majority of cases, they're going to slip on through and they're going to go all the way. Okay? So I don't have a list of what the cofactors are for delta 5 desaturase, but we can certainly look those up. And I think they're similar.
And the way that it's kind of in between the EPA and arachidonic acid in this graph, what does that mean? I know that if we have enough EPA, that can suppress some of the arachidonic acid, right?
Exactly.
And then can arachidonic acid, that cannot turn into EPA, or can it?
Arachidonic cannot turn into EPA, no. You can, EPA
so
can
once
turn
it becomes,
it is not a two-way street, no.
Oh, okay. Because I guess I was just confused how delta 5 is kind of in between them, and then it that just means the delta 5 is affecting both omega 3 and omega 6, and it's playing
elongation
a role in the conversions here. And
yeah.
Is there something once we're in so DGLA itself is not bad, but
no,
only
but it
once
can,
it turns into
can go down to PG1, but what happens is a lot of times it goes to arachidonic. When we do, we have a whole module on interpreting the fatty acid profile test. When we look at that and we see, like, where people are getting stuck, it helps us to see what's going on. And we do see sometimes that people are low in DGLA and high in arachidonic. And so if there's an inflammatory process going on in the body, like there's an injury, there's a bacterial infection, whatnot, the body's going to need more of the inflammatory, so the pathway would tend towards that way. But if somebody's got this mechanism that's just constantly being turned on, or sometimes when they're taking in, that turns this whole process off, then they don't get that. The DGLA does not get to convert into the anti-inflammatory, it gets converted into the inflammatory.
How can we make sure the DGLA converts into PG1?
Question. So this is one of the tests. Let me see if this is the one where. No, this is a good one. We have a lot more.
Is it also?
Yeah.
Is it also just basically if you take too much omega 6, at some point some will just turn into arachidonic acid because not all.
Oh yeah, that's the problem. Ratios, right? That's the problem with taking too much in the way of those omega 6 vegetable fats. Is that it's just inevitably going to go to arachidonic versus PG1 if there's too much.
Even if as GLA, like evening primrose oil or hemp seeds, even if we take it in that form, that can turn.
Yeah, you can trigger, yes, and you can take too much of that, absolutely.
Even Probably. Too much of a good thing.
That's, it's all about balance.
Okay, Yeah, this was very fascinating to me. Like, it made me rethink my everything.
Yay.
My whole diet.
Yeah.
And
you wonder
pathways
and you start to see them. And I don't remember all the cofactors for every little step, but sometimes I have to look it up. So if I get somebody whose DGLA is high and their arachidonic is low, then I'm looking at, I wonder what caused that to happen. And I remember looking up pathways, and I just don't remember whether it's zinc or B6 or what some of those cofactors are. A lot of them are shared cofactors. The big one is the big rate is the delta 60 saturates, because there's so many things that impact that, right? So many things depress it, right?
And if that doesn't work, the delta 60 saturates, none of these conversions will take place. It will just, the ALA,
right.
ALA will never convert. And what about linoleic acid? That will never convert either, or...
That's a good question, because what we see clinically is that the LA does tend to convert better. So I'm not sure if, that I don't know the answer to. That's a really good question, though. That's a really good question.
But you've probably never seen anybody with low LA, right, or low omega-6.
Rarely. I do occasionally in people who are just like, they're pumping the flax and the chia and the fish, and they're just not eating nuts or seeds or oils on the other side. Occasionally I've seen it. It's rare. And much more likely what I see is people with a ton of ALA, a ton of LA, and then I see very low EPA, DHA. That's very common, right? So I'll say to them, I know before they even up their diet. I used to do like just interpretations of the test. Didn't know much about the person, but I'd tell them about themselves based on like, are you eating flax seeds and chia seeds? Yeah, how'd you know that? Well, your ALA is really high, but your EPA, DHA, do you also eat like, do you take B vitamins and do you eat refined foods? Do you eat any crackers or breads or stuff? Yeah, I eat that stuff. Okay, those are deficient in your B vitamins. That's thwarting that conversion. So you're taking all this great flax, but you're still eating the white rice and the white pasta, and it's causing you not to be able to convert. Right, and I can also look in at somebody when they have a low ALA and they have a high EPA DHA. I'll say, taking fish oils, right? And they'll go, yeah, how'd you know? I didn't tell you that. Well, I could tell by this, the way this looks. So the more you read them, the more you really interpret, and you can help people. And it's really good because you might be telling people, get off of those refined stuff and don't eat those white rice or whatever they're eating. And they don't really listen to you. But when you show them here, and you say, oh, it looks like you're, it looks like, and they go, how did you know all that? I said, well, based on this pathway. And this is going to cause inflammation. This can affect your cardiovascular system, and this can affect your joints and your muscles. And remember you said you had fibromyalgia? Ah, this can affect it. And so it gives them, these tests really, well, I run a lot of these. You'll see when we do the fatty acid, there's a whole module on this test. And case after case.
And then one more thing. It's not in this chart, but it's one of the on the same module. The one that's not in this chart, membrane phospholipids.
Okay, which one is that in? Is that the first one?
That appears in both inflammatory cascade and nutritional modulation. It's towards the last four slides. Yeah, on the same PDF, on the same PowerPoint. So it appears in all of those. Yeah, it appears in nutritional modulation and inflammatory cascade and drug modulation.
Okay, so what are you asking about here?
So membrane phospholipids, they turn directly into arachidonic acid, right?
Or they contain arachidonic acid.
They contain
food. So when you eat meat, in particular, meat and pork and beef and chicken and all that, the membranes, the lipids, that contains the arachidonic acid, or they get easily converted. A lot of them contain arachidonic. The only plant food I know of that contains significant amounts of preformed arachidonic is peanuts. Peanuts do.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I saw that in the lecture. So what are these membrane phospholipids?
So when you're eating foods, animal foods, they have cell structure like we do. So the membranes contain phospholipids, the phosphorus combined with a lipid structure. We had a picture of that in one of the others. And those can contain arachidonic acid as part of the fat.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And then on
nutritional modulation slide, it shows vitamin E and curcumin, so they prevent it.
They prevent that
membrane from phospholipids
down into arachidonic acid.
Turning into.
Right.
Oh, okay. All right.
Exactly.
Yeah,
the reds are always
are
the accelerators, and the reds are the decelerators.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thank you for clarifying.
Yeah.
I want to make sure I understand before I move on to the next.
Well, I'm glad you do, because I really want you guys to understand this stuff, because it just becomes a part of your natural, the way you look at things. When people start to explain things, you start to see these pathways in your brain. Believe me, I do, and I start to see them in the air, and people look at me like I'm crazy.
Yeah, I'm thinking of it differently now, even though before I knew omega-3s are important, omega-6. Eat one or less of them, but now I see why, and I'm different motivation here.
Yeah, cool.
All right, well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Looks like somebody commented here. Let's see. Okay, so Lynn said successful DGLA downstream metabolism omega-6 to PG1 is secured by omega-3 EPA blockage of arachidonic acid. If those particular omega-3 metabolites are present in the body. So when a person is low in EPA, then you're going to see less of the DGLA going down to PG1 and more of the DGLA going back to EPA, I mean to arachidonic.
Mm.
And an adequate amount.
Okay.
Similar to the delta-6 desaturase, vitamin A, C, B6, zinc, and gamma. Tocopherol stabilize omega-6 and omega-3 and enhance the delta-6 desaturase enzymatic conversion of omega-6 to LA. Do you, Lynn, I would love you to save me that article, like a link to the article where you found that, because that sounds, that's good stuff. And you maybe want to add that. Explain the benefits, true. Yeah, cool. Thank you. All right. Let's go back and see if anybody else has questions. Otherwise, we will be done for today. Let's see. Maestro or Owl? Find us again. Oh, there we go. Okay, so that was Alma. Looks like Sequoia has her hand up one more time now that she's back again. Had a little trouble there. Hi, Sequoia.
Hi. I have another question. You know, we often refer to sugar spikes, and we'll see... if you have a spike, then, and it's above 120, that can be a problem. How long is a spike a spike before it becomes a problem?
That's a good question. Anytime it goes up from, you know, more than a couple of seconds, it can start to cause damage. So some people think, well, I eat this food, my blood sugar goes to 140, but 45 minutes later it's back down to 100. Is that really a problem? You know, it's not as much of a problem as it would be if it went up higher or lasted longer, but there's just some damage every time, and it might be minor, and there may be times when you say, screw it, I'm just going to have this chocolate, and I know my blood sugar will be back down in 45 minutes, and I'm going to take my chances because most of the time I'm really good. Fine. But it's you know, it's always the accumulation of little things that we need to be aware of with people. A little of this, a little of that, a little of this, a little of that, and it all adds up to a lot of stress on the body. So, yeah, I mean, if it goes up, like temporarily, I believe, and this is just based on what I've seen with blood sugar testing, that it's a constant flux, right? Blood sugar goes way up, it comes back down. It goes up, it comes down. Usually we're not going to catch those high ups. But sometimes people do, and I've had that on occasion because I test my blood sugar a lot, where I'll test it and I'll go, what, 180, that's ridiculous. And I go test it again immediately three times in a row, and it's, you know, 96. So I think sometimes it's that, the body detects there's blood sugar's high, oh, insulin brings it right back down. Oh, it's high, brings it right back down. But it's when it's up for any length of time that's measurable. Like if you were able to measure it being above 120, you know, more than three times in a row or three times in a row, then it's probably up there too long.
Right. So you, let's say we're talking about a 5 minute period then, you know, I mean, because
5 minutes. How damage can you do in 5 minutes? You know, maybe not significant if it's only 5 minutes out of a year, but if it's 5 minutes every day and we're causing a little bit of peripheral nerve damage or we're causing a little bit of retinal damage, then, yeah, it's like, do you smoke a cigarette? Maybe you smoke a cigarette for 5 minutes a week. Is that damaging? Well, it's certainly not as damaging as somebody who smokes a cigarette, you know, five of them a day or 20 of them a day. But is it still going to cause some damage? Yes, and it depends on how strong or weak your constitution is otherwise and what other factors you have there that are protective.
Yeah, and then there's also the, you know, your ability to repair quickly. There's so it's very individual. Yeah, okay.
Very
I just wanted to know your take on it.
Yeah, very individual. You know, that's what I feel like. Some people say, well, if I have an occasional glass of wine, I usually don't, but every couple of months I have a little alcohol, it's no big deal. It may not be a big deal, but if they're still suffering from fibromyalgia and hyperthyroidism and all kinds of problems, it could be. It could be that little link that's not allowing them to heal fully, right? Now, certain people with that gene, that alcoholism gene or the cravings kind of thing, which I believe that I have, if I were to sit down and have a glass of wine, it would trigger those crazy, the crazy genes to go like, oh, I can have another glass of wine. What the heck? Oh, let me have the whole bottle. I'm not going to do this again for another year. I might as well just go at it. And that's how I've always been with sugar or alcohol or bread or whatever. So I just say, screw it. I'm staying away from it completely. I don't want to have to deal with having to have willpower. I don't like having willpower. I never use willpower. I don't get myself in situations where I need willpower. But those kind of things physiologically change things. So it just depends, right? If a person's otherwise perfectly healthy and their blood sugar occasionally goes up because they occasionally indulge, it's not a big deal. But if it's somebody who already has some peripheral nerve damage or they're having paresthesias or they have some retinal damage already, every little bit is just a little bit more fuel on the fire. And everybody has to make their own choice as to what their poisons are.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Great. You know, it's all, we all choose our poisons, and my poison is staying up too late sometimes. But think about it, right? If somebody, they stay up too late, and then they're dragging the rest of the day, and then they're drinking caffeine all day to keep them, you know, going, and sugar, they're not sleeping, is really damaging for them. But for me, I stayed up till 4:30. I had to get 5 videos done. I got it done. I got up, you know, at 8:30 or 9 o'clock, whatever it was. I got up. I started working. I haven't eaten anything yet all day. I feel fine. My brain is working. Was that sleep? Yeah, that sleep was detrimental to me because I could have been sleeping and doing some more repair. But is it as detrimental to me as it would be to someone else who's not in as good a shape as I am? So we all have to just pick our poisons and negotiate with our clients and patients a lot when it comes to what we want them to do, right? Any other questions? Comments? Just open your lines up and we can say goodbye then. We'll get to see if there's anything else here in this. Evelyn, if you could save this, I want to read through the comments in this chat. I would so appreciate it if you could save it for me. Let me open up the lines and just get some feedback. Did everybody learn something today?
Yes, always. Yes. Thank you.
We learn from each other, and I think that that's the beauty of, you know, coming together in groups like this, because your questions stimulate something I may not have thought about. I look up and go, ooh, I just learned something new, right? Or vice versa. So I think it's really great for us to be active on these calls, and I love what we're doing here, and I appreciate it. And I hope to see all of you next month. I know some of you I am for sure, and I hope, you know, as many of you as possible can come hang out with us in Florida. It's going to be in like a month from now, a little over a month and a week, so 5 weeks from now. So if you haven't already registered, get yourself registered. We're going to have a blast. and we're going to learn a lot. Imagine 3 days of being with these amazing people. It's going to be amazing. All right. So take care, everybody. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye, everyone.